Mark 12, and we begin in verse 28. And one of the scribes came up and heard them disputing with one another, and seeing that he answered them well, asked him, "Which commandment is the most important of all?" Jesus answered, "The most important is, 'Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength.' The second is this, 'You shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these.' And the scribe said to him, 'You are right, teacher. You have truly said that he is one and that there is no other besides him. And to love him with all the heart and with all the understanding and with all the strength, and to love one's neighbor as oneself is much more than all whole burnt offerings and sacrifices.' And when Jesus saw that he answered wisely, he said to him, 'You are not far from the kingdom of God.' And after that, no one dared to ask him any more questions." And you can be seated. Well, as I mentioned last week, we're slowing down a little bit to dive in deeper into what Jesus says when he says, "Love God and love neighbor." That's the question that the scribe asks, which is the greatest commandment. Jesus actually responds with two: love God and love neighbor. And I think it's fair to say that if there's anything we need to be sure that we understand as believers, it's these two commands. I mean, if Jesus says these are the greatest ones, I think we need to be very careful that we obey them. And so that's why I want to slow down and tease these out a little. Next week, we'll just cover this section in particular with the scribe. But first, I do want to unpack this idea of loving neighbor. And I do just want to say, even before we get to that, is that these two commands are amazing in just many ways. We can spend a lot of time on what it means to love God, a lot of time on what it means to love neighbor. Just to give you one way in which I think they are amazing is that they really sum up the entirety of what God has commanded us to do. So in the Old Testament, there were 613 laws for the Israelites to follow. Now, I don't know who counted those, and I've never double-checked, but that's what everybody says. There's 613 laws. That's the number that everyone gives. But let's say that's true. How do you abide by 613 laws? How do you actually do that? And especially if you think about those people in the Old Covenant, they did not have a copy of the Bible like we do. They didn't have their own copy. They probably knew the Ten Commandments. Most of them probably knew that. But how do you actually keep track of 613 commands when you don't even have all of the commands written in your home? Well, you can just boil it down to two: love God and love your neighbor. It's just that easy. Just boil it all down to two. That's really the umbrella. And if you think about it, even the Ten Commandments are boiled down to two. Usually what's called the first table of the law, those first four commandments: no other gods, no images, do not take the Lord's name in vain, and keep the Sabbath. That's how we love God. And then the other six: do not murder, do not commit adultery, honor your father and mother, and so on. That's really how do we love our neighbor. And a lot of people think that the rest of the commands, the other 603, are really just an extrapolation on those basic 10. So really, the central ethic of the people of God from time immemorial is love God and love neighbor. And this morning we're on love neighbor. It's when Jesus says, "So whatever you wish others would do to you, do also to them, for this is the law and the prophets." You want me to sum up how to love people or how to treat people in the Old Covenant? It's do to them what you would want them to do to you. That's love. That's his command. And that's what love is. It's doing. It's action. Doing to others what we would want them to do for us. That's what love is. Now, we saw last week that loving God is hard, and it takes gospel motivation to love him. We love him because he first loved us. I would argue, and maybe this is just me, but I would argue actually loving people is harder than loving God. Why is that? Because people are just the worst. Like, we're just hard to love because we're sinners. God is perfect. God is merciful. God is kind. He's always just. He's always right. And even when we're commanded to love God and we fall short of that, like, there's still this idea of like, yeah, I know I should be doing it. But with people, we're like, do I really have to? Like, do I really have to love people because they're sinful and they're wretched? And if you think about it, our love for people is very unlike our love for God. So just a couple examples. We never have to forgive God. We never have to forgive God. God never sins. We are called to forgive people. People sin against us all the time, and it's very difficult for us to overcome that. God is also wise, and he rules the whole universe and the whole course of history by his wisdom. And people are often really foolish. I think we could just confess, we are often really foolish in the things that we do. I've done foolish things thinking they're actually wise, and my foolishness affects other people. And that's true for all of us. And then, this is kind of an interesting thought, people are often just strange. We're just kind of weird. In John Piper's book, This Momentary Marriage, he talks about how spouses often have to deal with sin, but they also have to deal with strangeness. Okay? So people often sin against us, but people are just strange. And that's true even outside of marriage. You guys, we're all just sort of weird. And we got to put up with that, and we got to deal with that, and we have to love people in spite of the fact that we're all just weird. And the fact that you don't think that you are weird just means you are weird in your own special way. I'm weird in my own special way. So although the command to love God is primary, I think the command to love people is often more difficult. And so we have this as the second command. How do we keep the command? How are we supposed to do it? And let me tell you, we're going to spend some time this morning in an unexpected place. You know, if you think about loving people, where would you take them in the Bible to talk about loving people? We could talk about the parable of the Good Samaritan. Who is my neighbor? How do I love my neighbor? We could go to the parable of the Good Samaritan, talk about loving people. And often, I think, as Christians, we're shamed by how much more unbelievers love people than even we love people. And that's really the parable of the Good Samaritan. We go to 1 Corinthians 13, right, where love is patient, love is kind, that whole list right there. But I actually think that Jesus tells us exactly where to go, exactly what he wants us to expound on when he says to love our neighbor as ourself. Just like last week, he quotes a verse in the Old Testament, and this is where it was originally written, is in Leviticus 19. So I want us to turn to Leviticus 19, and we're going to spend most of our time in Leviticus 19. So turn there. The command that Jesus quotes is technically in verse 18 of chapter 19. But you know when you quote a movie line to somebody or a line of a song to somebody, something like that? And really what you're doing when you're quoting just one line or a phrase or something like that is you're importing the whole context of the movie and that whole scene into whatever it is you're talking about or whyever it is you're quoting it. Well, it's sort of the same thing when the New Testament authors quote the Old Testament, or even sometimes when the Old Testament authors quote the Old Testament. They'll quote just a little passage, and what they're doing is they're importing the whole context into the discussion. They're expecting us to know that. And so that's why Jesus and the apostles often just do a little phrase or something. They're not cherry-picking out of the Old Testament. What they're doing is they're assuming that you're going to know that whole context and bring it into what they're talking about. And that's what's going on here. So if you look at Leviticus 19, verse 18, the very last little section, like last half of the verse, it says, "But you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord," or "I am Yahweh." Okay, that's what Jesus quotes. But the section that he's wanting us to import in that whole discussion is actually verses 9 through 18. It's this whole section where Moses expounded on what it is to love our neighbor. In verses 1 through 8, Moses expounded a little bit on what it is to love God. And then in verse 9 through 18, we see that he's actually expounding on what it is to love our neighbor. So that's what I want to do. I want to read this section, and then I want to unpack it for us. Because I think this is really what Jesus has in mind when he's saying, love your neighbor as yourself. So take a look, verse 9. He says, "When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap your field right up to the edge. Neither shall you gather the gleanings after you harvest. And you shall not strip your vineyard bare. Neither shall you gather the fallen grapes of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and for the sojourner. I am Yahweh, your God." Verse 11, You shall not steal. You shall not deal falsely. You shall not lie to one another. You shall not swear by my name falsely and so profane the name of your God. I am Yahweh. Verse 13, you shall not oppress your neighbor or rob him. The wages of a hired worker shall not remain with you all night until the morning. You shall not curse the deaf or put a stumbling block before the blind, but you shall fear your God. I am Yahweh. Verse 15, you shall do no injustice in court. You shall not be partial to the poor or defer to the great, but in righteousness shall you judge your neighbor. You shall not go around as a slanderer among your people, and you shall not stand up against the life of your neighbor. I am Yahweh. You shall not hate your brother in your heart, but you shall reason frankly with your neighbor, lest you incur sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am Yahweh. So this is the context of what Jesus is quoting. When he's asked this question and he responds with, love your neighbor as yourself, he's bringing in this whole context into the discussion. And so I want to spend a little time here because I think it's important for us to understand what he's getting at. First of all, remember last week when we talked about the command to love God, that was from Deuteronomy 6. Hear, O Israel, Yahweh your God, Yahweh is one, and you shall love Yahweh. Remember that I said then, and is true here too, but it is Yahweh who defines what love to him is. We don't get to define that. Yahweh gets to define that. We don't get to decide. And actually, it appears that for the most part, like I said earlier, in verses 1 through 8, Yahweh is defining how to love him again here in this section. It's sort of a recap of the commands to love God. Well, in the same way, it is God who determines how we love our neighbor. We don't get to decide how to love our neighbor. We don't get to decide what love is or is not. And what's interesting, I don't know if you noticed this, but throughout this section we read, I am the Lord, or I am Yahweh. 5 times in this little section, he says it. Verse 10, verse 12, 14, 16, and 18. Basically at the end of every little paragraph, if you've got paragraphs. I am Yahweh your God. I am Yahweh. I am Yahweh. I am the Lord. I am the Lord. Which is kind of interesting. Why say that about these commands? Because he's making it clear that he determines what love of neighbor is. Yahweh determines what love is. Not us, not the culture, not the media, not social media, goodness. He determines. And these are very clear commands. And I think, like I said last week, we need to understand that love for our neighbor is not determined by our feelings. It's not determined by our sentiment. It's not determined by what our culture says love is. It's defined by the Lord. And just to give some examples, because people will do these things in the name of love. Doing things with your boyfriend or your girlfriend that you should only do with your husband is not love. Giving the cold shoulder to your neighbor because you don't want to talk to them and you don't want to ruffle feathers is not love. Using someone's preferred pronouns is not love. God defines what love is, you guys, and God alone, how we are to love our neighbor. Now, we're going to get into this, I really promise, but just really quick, when we're reading through the law in the Old Testament, we need to think oftentimes in terms of principles rather than just the specifics. Sometimes God gives us the specifics in the law, sometimes he gives us the principles, and we need to think, what are they trying to get at? What are these laws trying to get at? So, a lot of times your question should be, what's the bigger picture principle that's being laid down here for us to apply to ourselves? We're not under the law in terms of keeping the law for justification. But inasmuch as the law is wise and good, we should seek to follow it because we are following the Lord. So we're thinking principally right. So the first thing we see love is be generous to the poor. Be generous to the poor. We see that in verses 9 and 10. When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap your field right up to its edge, neither shall you gather the gleanings after you harvest, and you shall not strip your vineyard bare, neither shall you gather the fallen grapes from your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and for the sojourner. I am Yahweh your God. So in ancient times, you would have a field, you'd have maybe wheat or barley or something going on in there, and you would not go all the way to the road. You'd leave the last, whatever it was, 10 feet, 15 feet, whatever it was, along the road so that if someone is walking by, they could glean, they could harvest. Same thing with a vineyard. You wouldn't strip the whole thing bare. Usually you would go through one time, and that was it. That was all you got to make your wine, and then the rest was left for those who were poor. Now, it would be easy to read this and think, well, I don't have a field, and I certainly don't harvest, so I'm good. I don't need to bother with this. But again, the principle here is that we are generous to the poor and to the sojourner. And you have to kind of stop and go, well, but what does that mean? What does it mean that we're generous to the poor and generous to the sojourner? Well, first of all, I think that it means we need to plan for generosity. We need to plan for generosity. The landowners in Israel's day had no idea who would be wandering by their field. They didn't have like the census data of how many people, you know, would be migrating through Israel on their way to somewhere else. And, you know, well, we need 10 feet this year or 18 feet or something. Like, they didn't have that. So God just left it open. Listen, just leave some along the side of your fields. Plan for this. Don't go through your field twice and pick up all the gleanings. God just said to do this. Plan for this. Build this in. Make sure that you don't harvest to the edge of the fields. And if you drop any, don't go pick it up. In fact, it's kind of funny. There's two places in the Bible where I get kind of choked up. Number one is the Joseph story, and especially with, you know, Judah there. And then the other one is with Boaz and Ruth. You read Ruth recently? And so this is the beautiful part of Ruth where, you know, Ruth is going. She's this widow. She goes to the field, and she's doing this. She's harvesting the edge. And it's dangerous because it's the time of the judges and everybody's doing what's right in their own eyes. But she's harvesting the edge. And you remember Boaz, in his kindness, says, hey, guys, leave some of the bundles for her. He actually goes above and beyond the call of duty to provide for her. And then he says to Ruth, don't go anywhere else. You're going to stay in my field. Get choked up. You're going to stay in my fields because I'm going to protect you. Like, that's love for the neighbor. And she's a Moabitess. She's a foreigner. Why would you, and she even says that, why would you treat me a dog like this? And he's like, well, I've heard of your kindness toward your mother-in-law. But this was the generosity that the people of God were called to do. Now, again, in the book of Ruth, when he invites her to that, he doesn't give her a handout, does he? He gives her the opportunity to come work. But she has to work. And that's the biblical ethic here. Anyone who is not willing to work, let him not what? Eat. Let him not eat. And so there's this balance. We want to plan for generosity, but we don't just give handouts. Loving our neighbor means that we call them to work hard, and we call them to work excellently. And I think this is true as Christians for sure. Christians should be known as the hardest working people in society. In the place where you work, your boss should be like, hey, do you have more people from church? Like, who would like a job? Like, because I see what you do, and you're kind of weird because you're a Christian, but you get the stuff done, and I want more people like you. Like, they should make that connection. They should understand that work is happening because we follow Jesus. Put it a different way, it is not loving our neighbors to let them think that they can just live on government handouts and not have some sort of gainful employment or not operate a household well. And just to get really specific, it's not loving your teenage neighbor or your 20-something neighbor to let them think that they can just exist in your basement forever without some sort of gainful employment or pursuing something or contributing little or nothing to the home. Because I think that's actually stealing from the parents, is what it is. I don't even think it's loving our very little neighbors to just give them allowance handouts. Make them work for it. There should be a connection between hard work and earning. And there should be planned generosity that demands work. This is what the gospel says. This is in Ephesians 4:28. Let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor doing honest work with his own hands so that he may share something with anyone in need. So the gospel transforms people from thieves into those who are generous, hardworking people, preparing to be generous. The gospel also calls us to provide for relatives, including older parents, as well as members of our own household. In fact, Paul says in 1 Timothy 5:8, if we don't do that, if we're not willing to work and provide for members of our own household, we are worse than unbelievers. I don't know what that means, but how are you worse than an unbeliever? The gospel calls us to provide. And I get it, you guys were, you know, there are times where we're between jobs or laid off or injured. Maybe we got fired, whatever. And it can be hard. I've been there. It can be hard. Difficult to keep going looking for a job. And I think part of the reason that's hard, just a little side note here, is because we're made in the image of God, and especially for men, it's to provide. Like, that's built deep within us, to provide and protect. And we need to do that. We need to get back to that. But it is easy to think love is just giving out everything someone needs. But it's not. It's planned generosity, but demanding hard work. Second, love is honest. Love is honest. Verses 11 and 12. You shall not steal. You shall not deal falsely. You shall not lie to one another. You shall not swear by my name falsely and so profane the name of your God. I am Yahweh. So love is honest, and I think honesty expresses itself in a variety of ways. We don't steal from our neighbor. That is, we don't take that which is not ours. It seems like this is obvious, but it has to be said. We don't take something that is not ours. Well, they took something from me, so I'm going to take something from them. It doesn't matter. You know, it's just insignificant. It's small. It's not a big deal. No big deal. But we don't do that. This could be stealing time at work. This could be stealing tax money. Stealing your brother's toys, stealing money, stealing food. It's interesting. I've bought and sold a lot of vehicles and motorcycles and stuff over the years, and I cannot count how many times the guy has asked me, hey, can you put a less amount on the bill of sale so I don't have to pay as much taxes? No. That would be lying, and that would be stealing. I'm sorry. That's built into the price of the car. That's what we do. They want to pay less taxes. And this is an interesting situation because from their perspective, if we wrote less, it'd be loving them, wouldn't it? See, you're helping me. You're saving me some money. Well, is it loving them? No, it's not. It is not loving them. You can't violate one commandment to keep another. They're in harmony with each other. And so the problem is if we do that, then we have no integrity. We're liars. We're also thieves. And you can't lie and steal with your neighbor and then claim that you love them. And if we're going to be dishonest in this one area, where else are we going to be dishonest? It's going to just spread. I've been at restaurants, I've been at coffee shops where people lie about their birthday to get a free dessert or a free drink. I remember reading the book of Freakonomics. This is like 10 or 15 years ago or something like that. And they talked about in 1987, something like 7 million people disappeared from America. 7 million just vanished overnight. Because in 1987, you were required to put a social security number with every dependent on your tax return. And amazingly, 7 million people just vanished. Where did they go? Well, people were claiming dependents on their tax returns that weren't actually dependents. What are they doing? They're lying. They're stealing from the government, stealing from the rest of us who are paying into the government. So what is stealing? I think we know this. It's any wrongful taking of what's not yours. And the easiest way to figure that out is to simply ask, if the person who owned it were standing right there, would we do the same thing? And if the answer is no, it's stealing. It's just basic. And I know sometimes you just have to say basic things to get it back down to what the principle really is. Would you do what you're doing if they were watching? Or would your actions change if they were there? And if they would, then you're not loving your neighbor, you're stealing from them. And dealing falsely, he says in verse 11, you shall not deal falsely. It's the same kind of idea. Dealing falsely is basically conning people. It's stealing or withholding some kind of advantage or taking some kind of advantage, because you're either lying to them or you're not disclosing the full truth. And it would change their actions if they knew it. That's part of it too. It's the proverbial used car salesman who doesn't tell you that the brakes are bad. Like, they know it, but like, well, you know, maybe you got a little time on them or whatever. Like, a little time by 4 miles? Like, is that what we're talking about? Or 4 months? It's failing to disclose all those hidden fees on your cell phone contract. It drives me nuts. It's not telling somebody what's wrong with the item that you're selling on Craigslist or Marketplace. Proverbs talks about unequal weights and measures. That's a form of lying. It's not being honest with the situation. And it's even more serious if you take an oath. Verse 12, you shall not swear by my name falsely, by the Lord's name, and so profane the name of your God. I am Yahweh. So when you swear by the name of Yahweh, you're taking an oath or you're using God's name. You're literally saying, I swear to God, whatever. You're bringing on an oath onto yourself. You are invoking God as a witness between you and this person. Usually we do this in marriage or in legal contracts or something like that. But Ecclesiastes 5 says, when you make a vow to God, do not delay to fulfill it. He has no pleasure in fools. Fulfill your vow. It is better not to make a vow than to make one and not fulfill it. Do not let your mouth lead you into sin. And do not protest to the temple messenger, my vow was a mistake. Why should God be angry at what you say and destroy the work of your hands? Much dreaming and many words are meaningless. Therefore, fear God. That's stark. That's a warning. Be very careful invoking God in a vow. We often promise things very flippantly, even vowing to God. Jesus said, let your yes be yes and your no what? No. Be very careful with what we say. And again, just even on a personal level, I don't know how many times a day I'm asked by my kids to do something or another. And the reality is that our lives have so many moving pieces. Like, I'd like to fix your bike. I'd like to go take you and do this thing. I very rarely talk in concrete terms. Like, I'll try to do this afternoon. That is the plan. The plan could change if something comes up. Now, we want to be careful on the other side that we, you know, never obligate ourselves to anything. That's not good either. But we need to be very careful telling people this is what we're doing for sure. If it's God's will, we'll do it. I'm going to try the best I can, but I'm not going to promise anything because love is honest. Number three, love does not take advantage. Love does not take advantage. Look at verse 13 and 14. You shall not oppress your neighbor or rob him. The wages of a hired worker shall not remain with you all night until the morning. You shall not curse the deaf or put a stumbling block before the blind, but you shall fear your God. I am Yahweh. So again, remember, we're talking principles here. So what is oppression? Oppression is where you have the advantage over someone and they're kind of at your mercy. You have some strong position over them. You know, so your neighbor mows your lawn for an agreed price. It's the neighbor kid, you know, and you don't pay them right away. You said you would, and you maybe even have the money, but you're lazy, whatever. It's the neighbor kid, and you're withholding payment from them. You decide not to do it. You tell your kids, hey, do these 5 things, and then we'll go get a treat. But then you're like, yeah, but do this and do this. And do this and do this, and 5 turns into 10. You're oppressing them. Why? Because what are they going to do? Say no? But your word said do 5, and now you're making it 10. There's nothing they can do. Your buddy buys you lunch, and you keep forgetting to pay them back. They gave to you, but you don't make it a point to give back to them. It's when we use our power and our situation, our position, to the disadvantage of others. It's like the husband who always buys nice things for himself, but never nice things for his wife. The older brother oppressing the younger brother because they're stronger. The mechanic who's got your car on the lift and says, hey, I need to do these 3 other things, and they're going to charge you exorbitantly. What are you going to do? You don't have a car, and it's up on a lift. They got you over a barrel. It's oppression. It's the in-home care worker stealing from their client or abusing their clients. And the example here, it's an interesting example of not putting a stumbling block in front of a blind person or cursing a deaf person. Is a little odd, I think. I don't know if too many people are like, you know what I'm going to go do today? I'm going to go trip blind people. I'm going to stand behind that deaf person, and I'm just going to launch 4-letter words at them. Like, that's what I'm... Like, you got to be really sick and weird if that's, like, the thing you wake up to do every morning. But here's the thing. It's not that people would actually do them. It's that when we oppress people, that's functionally what we are doing. It's taking advantage of them. They are proverbially blind to the situation. There's nothing they can do. They're at our mercy. And so we might as well be out tripping blind people. We might as well be out cursing deaf people. Because that's the kind of offensiveness that this is. That's the image. It's we take advantage of people. They're blind, as it were, that we're at their or that they are at our mercy. And so there's this level of trust that we have been given to ensure that we're doing right things with other people. Number four, love is not partial. Love is not partial. Verse 15, you shall do no injustice in court. You shall not be partial to the poor or defer to the great. But in righteousness shall you judge your neighbor. You shall not go around as a slanderer among your people, and you shall not stand up against the life of your neighbor. I am Yahweh. So this is the sin of partiality. Partiality is giving favor to one class of people simply based on their class. Or it could be disfavor, depending on the situation. So the classic example here is like racism, right? We're quick to give justice to a certain skin color, or we're wary of a particular ethnic group. And we justify it even, maybe. Well, I know so many, you know, whatever of this kind of people. And they act like that. Jewish people this, and Hispanic people that, and black people this, and white people that, or enter your category. No, that's the sin of partiality, is what it is. As though they're all the same. With the Me Too movement and the Church Too movement a few years ago, there was this idea of believe every woman. You remember that? That was the thing, believe every woman. And it even came up with a Supreme Court nomination. So a woman was accusing a high-profile judge who was on deck to be a Supreme Court justice, and she was accusing him of doing all these things. And we should believe her. Why? Because she's a woman. As a women never lie. Sorry, ladies. I know the Bible. You lie. We lie. Everybody lies. So should we just believe people because they're a woman? And the answer is no. Well, why wouldn't you believe her? Why would she lie? And our response to that is because this is not biblical justice. This is not biblical justice. It is not fair to women, and it's not fair to men. Biblical justice says that we're going to evaluate the situation based on all the facts that we can gather. And we're going to evaluate the situation based on all the evidence and all the testimony. Both sides get a chance to tell their story. Proverbs 18:17 says, the one who states his case first seems right until the other comes and examines him. Both sides get an opportunity to tell the story. This is why in our society, when you see, you know, the judicial system or whatever, Lady Justice is blindfolded. She's blindfolded and she's holding out a scale. It's as though she can't see who's on the stand. She can't see who the parties are. She's evaluating, she's weighing the scales on purely the merits of the argument, regardless of who's making those arguments. And you can tell in the passage, some people side with poor people. Why? Because they're poor. They must be oppressed all the time. Poor people would never do anything wrong. They'd never steal. They'd never do anything right. And some people side with the rich people. Rich people never do anything wrong. They never do anything bad or steal or whatever. And that's the issue, is the partiality here based on economics, which also happens in our society. Often happens in our society. I remember working at a granite fabrication plant. This is back in Kentucky. It was like 20 years ago. And one of the workers, he was this, you know, low on the totem pole guy. And the owner of the company came up and they always complained about how much Larry was making. And so he brings Larry over and he has the audacity to ask Larry. He's like, Larry, why you make so much? Like, that's what he asked. The owner, his boss who signs his paycheck. Why you make so much? And Larry looks around and he goes, at this like 30,000 foot fabrication facility with like millions of dollars of equipment. And he goes, I've got about $600,000 into this thing. How much did you put in? How much did you contribute? And he goes, well, none. And he's like, I employ 80 people. So I'm responsible for 80 households. How many households are you responsible for? He goes, well, one. I'm like, okay. So I've got a bigger responsibility. I've got a bigger investment here. And I make a little bit more than you do. And it really was only a little bit. Larry wore old ratty blue jeans and this old tweed sweater. He drove around a 12-year-old, you know, van. Like he was not like out there, you know, bling bling. And this guy had the audacity to go, well, why do you make more? This is why. Because I've got 80 mouths to feed. That's why. Not everybody who's rich is oppressing. And not everybody who's poor is content and innocent. We'd be very careful when we're coming into especially a legal situation of understanding that. And then he goes on in verse 16. He says, you shall not go around as a slanderer among your people, and you shall not stand up against the life of your neighbor. I am Yahweh. So not only do we not prejudge, we also don't slander our neighbor. Slander is speaking things that ought not to be spoken about concerning that person. It could be false accusations, or it could be actually stating the truth that you shouldn't be telling. And this is interesting because this is a legal situation. This happens all the time in legal situations where the parties are trying to discredit each other. And so they're slandering each other to try and undermine their credibility in the court system. Because if you can discredit the other party, your case has more weight and you will win. That's not how to love our neighbor. Yeah. Number 5, we love from the heart. We love from the heart. Take a look, 17 and 18. You shall not hate your brother in your heart, but you shall reason frankly with your neighbor, lest you incur sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am Yahweh. Now, the big principle here is love from the heart, because in both of these commands, the issue is the heart. We don't hate our neighbor in our heart. We don't bear a grudge. What that means is we don't have unresolved conflict with our neighbor. We seek to resolve our difficulties quickly and in a godly manner. That's what the people of God should do. How do we do that? Well, first he says, we go and we reason frankly with our neighbor. You know what frankly is? It's just, you get it out there. And you just deal with the situation. That's what you do. You just talk about it with our neighbor. We have to be honest with them about whatever is going on. We need to be able to resolve difficult issues. If you got beef with a friend, go talk to him. If you got beef with your neighbor, go talk to him. You got beef with your wife, go talk to her. Got beef with your family or whoever, go talk to them. Just go have an honest conversation. Say, here's what's going on. And of course, he sums up the whole thing, that we don't take vengeance and we shall love our neighbor as ourselves. I am the Lord. How would we want our neighbor to love us? If we were in that same spot, how would we want them to do it? And this is honestly one of the, I think, the best pieces of advice you can give to somebody. Like, hey, I've got to go deal with this difficult situation. How should I do it? And just ask yourself, well, flip the script. What if it was someone else who had a problem with you? How would you want them to approach you? How would you want them to talk with you? How would you want them to deal with it? And that's probably a pretty good roadmap of where you go in resolving the conflict. I mean, somebody had a problem with me, I just want them to come talk to me about it. Turn over to John 13. Where do we get this motivation to love like this? We're called to do this, but we don't feel like it. Where do we conjure this up? Well, just like we saw last time, how do we increase our love for God? Well, it's to remember how God loved us. Well, how do we increase our love for our neighbor? You know how we do that? We remember how God loved us. It's actually the same exact principle. It's the gospel, you guys. When Jesus calls us to love sinful, wretched people who really are the worst, he's calling us to do the same thing he did for us. is to be reminded of the gospel. And here in John 13, verses 34 and 35, we see that. John 13, verse 34. Jesus says, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another." Now, that's not new. We just saw that in Leviticus. But here's how it's new. "Just as I have loved you, you also are to love one another. By this, all people will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another." So it's not new in the sense that the people of God have always been told to love. It is new because now we've seen love embodied in Jesus, laying down his life for his people, flesh and blood, God in the flesh, doing this. So how does Jesus love us? Well, that's our picture of how to love one another. Having trouble loving your neighbor? Just how did Jesus love you? If Jesus had a problem with you, how would you want Jesus to deal with you? If you needed grace from Jesus, how would you want him to show grace to you? And that's what our picture is. And interestingly, notice this love is how the world will know that we are Christians. The greatest thing we can do for evangelism, the greatest thing that we can do to show other people who Jesus is and who Jesus is in our life, is how we love one another with these principles for God's glory. Let's pray. Father, it is hard to love our neighbor. And so we take this command very seriously. We want to be obedient, and we pray forgiveness when we're not. And we pray that you would give us the boldness and the courage and the fortitude and really the gospel reminder that we need to love our neighbor as ourself, that you would be honored and praised. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.